Hi, I'm Heather Monroe Bloom, and welcome to this town hall. I'm delighted to have such a good turnout. And let me just say, as words of introduction, that as much time as I may be on campus, and for those of us who are involved in various areas of the university in leading and running things, there's never enough opportunity to talk to members of the community, to students, to faculty, academic staff, librarians, administrative and support staff. So when I instituted the town halls, and we do two or three a year of these, 6 years ago, I think, 6 years ago now, it was really with an idea of getting to interact with parts of the community that I wouldn't normally come in contact with or would only by chance. So it is an opportunity for us to exchange ideas and views and information. It's really important for me to understand the issues that are on your mind and to the best of my ability to talk about areas, both those which you feel are going well and those that you feel could do with improvement, and to see if we can, in that way, strengthen our sense of community as McGill. I've been associated as a student or a professor or someone in a senior administrative academic role with six different universities in my time as an adult. And I found that there are many things about McGill that are unique, but one of them is the sense of caring for the institution that virtually every member feels. And we may take it for granted some days, but it is actually extraordinary the extent to which people take pride in the university, are proud of it after they leave here, hope to come before they come, and want to make the place better while they're here. And so it's in that spirit that we really come together to try and solve problems and also to celebrate the achievements of individuals and of groups within the university. And so I think simply with those opening words, I'll turn it over to the Deputy Provost, Student Life and Learning, who's been my partner in doing the town halls for 4 years, 5 years, time flies, for 5 years. And Professor Mendelson will just talk a little bit about the framework for what we do, but then my hope would be that we could have quite an informal exchange on a whole range of themes of current interest. Over to you.
Thank you, Madam Principal. And I'd like to welcome everyone here. It's terrific to be up in residence. Up in residences and to see a full house, so to speak. My job is really to keep things going. We have an hour. We want to hear from as many people as possible on as many topics as possible to get a range of views on a range of issues. I'm going to try to keep things going. I'm going to ask people to come to a microphone to talk. We're being webcast at the moment, and your questions won't be heard on the webcast if you're not at a microphone. We have a microphone in the middle, as you can see, and then we have a roving microphone for people in the back. So you can either come to the standing microphone or raise your hand to ask for the mic. I'd ask you to please identify yourself, identify your name, your program. If you're a student, perhaps what year you are in. As I said, we want to hear about a range of issues. Please feel free to use either French or English. On parle de langue ici. And before we start, I'd ask everyone to please turn off your cell phones. I'm going to turn off mine because I forgot to do that. And we can go directly to the questions now.
Maybe I could just also, Erica, recognize that you and thank you for the opportunity to be here at the residence and to host the town hall here. It's fantastic to have this opportunity. Thank you. Okay, over to you. Don't be shy.
My name is Ellie Friedman, U1 management student, economics finance. My question is, in light of the fact that part of a world-class education, which is what we expect at McGill, is quality of non-academic life, learning outside the classroom, flourishment in extracurricular activities, given the fact that it seems that there's already limited and dwindling resources at McGill and limited space and resources for non-academic extracurricular activities to flourish, and also in light of the fact that we've seen from future plans for our university to emphasize graduate research and graduate programs. So how can us undergraduate students approach the future with confidence that these lacking resources for non-academic activities, which are integral to our world-class education as a whole, will be completed and fulfilled, that gap will narrow?
Okay, thank you very much for the, you've got about six questions embedded in your one question. Let me try and respond to a couple of the themes that you've raised. First of all, you've talked about decreasing resources. In fact, we've increased our total revenues as a university year over year for the better part of the last decade, and we've increased our investment both in the academic part of the mission of the university, very much at the undergraduate level, and in the what you call the student life and learning amenities. That still begs the question of where would we like to be and how do we get there, but there's no question but that the overall investment in those domains has gone up. Secondly, so we're committed to that and we're committed to continuing to do that. I want to speak to one of the maybe issues embedded in your question, and that is undergraduate versus graduate, because there's suddenly, by virtue of my having spoken not only for graduate students, but having spoken for the cause of graduate students and postdoctoral fellows at the Commission Parlementaire in September, somehow that got construed as an abandonment of the undergraduate student and the undergraduate student programs and an embracing of graduate students. Quite the contrary. The undergraduate students and the graduate students, and frankly our postdoctoral fellows who fall into that sort of gray zone between students and staff, have been very much a part of our academic plan over the last 7 years. They were a dominant focus in the first task force that I ran on student life and learning. Indeed, the appointment of a deputy provost, student life and learning, with a very big responsibility for the undergraduate, but not undergraduate alone. These are new activities. The emphasis now on a couple of questions, the balance of the enrollment mix, undergraduate, graduate, professional students, and the fact that, in fact, we are increasing the graduate student enrollment at a faster rate than undergraduate, shouldn't take away from the fact that both have increased dramatically in the last decade. And in fact, although by Canadian standards we're a medium-sized university, we are large by American standards. So if you look at the public research-intensive universities in the U.S., McGill is a big place. And if you look at the quality of education and the quality of undergraduate education, which you asked directly about, there is a very strong view and experience of undergraduates that having a more graduate student intensive versus less graduate student intensive environment is better at the undergraduate level. It provides more opportunities for the research-teaching interface. It expands the opportunities to have mentoring and advising from a broader group of people in the university, and it enhances the global networks that students have as part of their educational experience. So please don't take the fact that we're saying graduate students are important as saying undergraduate students are not important, quite the opposite. We still want to do a lot more than we're able to do today, and we welcome your advice about how best to do that. But make no mistake about the fact that undergraduates are a strong priority.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
As you surely know, there was a recent protest, multiple protests, around the secretive way the Architecture Cafe issue was dealt with. Oh, sorry, it's Guy Mark Lifshitz, IMU for computer science. So as I was saying, it was really secretively done, and students have been very concerned about the outcome. Now, I've heard that the Board of Governors will deal with the issue, and I've heard that the Board of Governors will deal with it in a closed session. And now, considering how important it is to students and how the Board of Governors is the highest decision-making body at the university, I really request and am curious why it would meet in a closed session. I would request that it meets in an open session, because it only makes sense to see how decisions are made. And I guess the same issue for any Board of Governors meetings. I don't understand why they're meeting in closed sessions.
Okay. Well, let me again, you're smart. I know McGill students are smart. You're embedding a lot of questions in one question. Let me deal with these. First of all, there was no intent at all to make a decision about the Architecture Cafe in a closed way, and it was openly consulted and discussed within the department, architecture, the School of Architecture, where it has most obviously been an amenity for those who have seen it as such, and in the Faculty of Engineering within which it is. And one of the overarching issues there is that what does consultation mean? The question of what does consultation mean in a university? What does it mean in a university of 45,000 people? And how do you take decisions at a local level affecting dominantly local programs in a way that gets best information that you can about those who are most affected? So I think it came as a surprise to the administration that the view was that this was done quickly and without consultation. I don't think there was a view that it was done secretly. That would not represent the facts. Let me finish first, okay, please. But I think it is well accepted, certainly by me and by others, certainly the Deputy Provost, that people felt left out of that decision in the broader university context. And there's nothing secret that's happening at the board. Most of our board meetings have a good half of the meeting that are in open session. The decision was taken by the administration, not by the board, but by the administration to have a working group that will deal with matters of consultation and the process of consultation. How do we approach issues that affect students, but also others in the university community, in a way that has a process that reflects the fact, and this is where things seem to happen by surprise, especially for students, that many of the decisions that are taken in the university develop on a multi-year basis, and the implementation of those decisions also happens on a multi-year basis. So particularly given the fact that student leadership changes every year, those who are involved are often not here when they're implemented, and those who receive the outcome of those decisions often find they've just happened without them being consulted. So one of the major goals of the working group is to actually understand how we can consult in ways that have people who will be affected appropriately informed and engaged for their advice and interaction in that process.
Well, what about Board of Governors? Like, Board of Governors is discussing the issue.
And no, the Board of Governors discussed it.
And they discussed it in closed session, and they will discuss it again in a closed session on November 30th. I don't understand why they're in closed sessions. It's secretive. Like, if it's closed session, it is by definition secretive.
Well, there are representatives of each of the university's constituencies on the board.
But they represent.
There has been discussion in both open session and closed session on it. Let me just say that the whole issue of consultation and the processes of consultation are really important to us. I mean, that's why we started town halls. That's why I and others in the senior administration meet with the faculty councils and so forth. And we want to figure out how we have processes of consultation when, you know, hundreds of decisions get made every day at different levels across the university that give us some sense of how best to get advice, how best to involve those who will be affected. And we've got a broad working group. I think over half of the members are students on that working group to look at exactly that issue.
All right. I'll just end with, it seems to me that opening Board of Governors meetings would help with student consultation, since students will understand the issues better.
Yeah, thank you. And we have moved to having more and more of the Board of Governors meetings open. But there will always be closed session on various matters to protect confidentiality, to deal with issues of competitiveness on real estate and other things. So from a business point of view, from a fiduciary point of view, and from an oversight point of view, there is a need for the board to have some time in confidential session. But I agree totally that the more we can be open, and the same at Senate, the more open we will be.
All right, thanks.
Okay, thank you, and thanks for your point.
Excuse me, the principal was asked that the only video record of the event be the webcast.
I talked to that screen for the prior approval of the domain instead of
mine. Yeah. Yeah, no, we turned, it's simply not fair. We turned others down. Everybody was invited to plug into the webcast. Doug Sweet is right here.
There was an issue of, like, you weren't allowed to come at all. I didn't really understand. It's like, I asked.
You're welcome to be here, but I ask that you not video, but plug into the webcast. It's there and you can use it. And I'd ask the same about photos, that it's just simply distracting to the process. So I don't mind some at the beginning, some at the end, but I really ask that you just let us have an exchange here. Okay. Thank you. Really appreciate it.
Emily Essert, PhD 5. Madam Principal, I really appreciated what you said at the beginning in your opening comments about how important the university is to us. I did my undergraduate degree here as well, and I feel very strongly about McGill. And I wanted to take this opportunity to talk to you a little bit about the graduate experience in the Faculty of Arts.
Yeah.
Because what I found in my time here as a graduate student, which is vastly different from what I had expected arriving, is that we're a department of have and have-nots. Those of us who are lucky enough to have shirks do just fine. Those of us who don't have shirks are having trouble getting by from month to month, and it becomes very difficult. I've been lucky that way. Many of my colleagues have not. Those of us who are lucky enough to obtain RA-ships have stable study space. Mm-hmm. Those of us who don't may or may not have appropriate study space available to them in the library. If the library's open spaces don't work for them, one of the more recent options has been paid study space offered in Ferrier, which, frankly, just isn't appropriate. When we go to teach for professional development, we may be offered... I got an email yesterday.
Okay, it's news to me. Yeah.
It was disappointing news. When we go to teach, there may or may not be TA ships available. There have been cuts to those.
So let me try and respond, because I think I get
beautiful.
The gist of
it. So you get where I'm going with
this. Yes, I do. And I'm really delighted to have the graduate student voice at a town hall. You've been one of the few over the years, and it's really important for the undergraduate students who are here as well to understand the tremendous challenges of providing the resources, not just for the undergraduates and not just for the life and learning parts, but for graduate students, it's absolutely core. So we know there's still a gap in the resources that we need. You know, when I talk about, I didn't start out on this point because it's a symptom. It's a means to an end. It's not the main event. But we are dramatically underfunded compared to our peers in Canada, and exponentially so compared to our peers south of the border. That's public research intensive universities with large undergraduate and large graduate programs. And if you look at the number of kind of indicators of how that expresses itself, certainly when I came in 2003, there was nowhere that it was more obvious than with the graduate student body on space, on financial resources for fellowships, on research and scholarly support. So we have a range of mechanisms that we've worked hard on to close that gap, including finding space. So one of the things we didn't say at the beginning is that if questions get raised that we can't answer, or surprises come up that surprise us that we don't know about, there is a website. I think it's called the Principal's Town Hall website. And Vaughn, is that what it's called? Principal Town Hall website? I'm glad that follows right off of it. We will post some responses on that in the next 2 weeks. Okay, so if there are issues that come up, and one, this paid space, Professor Nysel, is that news to you? Yeah, so the three of us who you might think would know about it have never heard of that, so it'd be interesting. And if you could just send in to my office the email, that'd be helpful to know, because I know nothing of it. It's never been discussed at the senior table, and it would be very irregular to do that. So we just want to understand more about it. But we are working very hard. In fact, Professor Nysel, who's the associate provost in administration of finance, in charge of facilities and a number of sustainability and environmental issues, and others, our physical development, has been working hard to do a survey of the way we can use our space so we bring more space to graduate students, so every graduate student has a space to work, which I know is not the case currently. And we have narrowed the gap in support for our graduate students so that we are moving closer and closer to where we hope to be, that is the top 3, 4, 5 universities in Canada that are, you know, that have our mission. But there's still a gap there. So how are we working to bridge it? We're working to bridge it through philanthropy, and a majority of our campaign to this point has gone to support students with a very special focus on providing financial aid for undergraduates and sufficient fellowship support for our graduate students. And the MIDAS program has taken us a long way in that regard, but there is still a gap. We look to our professors to build graduate student support and undergraduate research experience where they can, but very much graduate student support into their own applications to SHRC and CIHR and NSERC, the three major federal granting councils. And we work with foundations and industry and other organizations in appropriate ways consistent with our mission to get that support. So don't think for a moment there isn't a concerted effort. Dean Marty Crisworth is here, the Dean of Graduate Students and Postdoctoral Fellows, and we actually are looking, as we do at the financial aid gaps for undergraduate students, we look at this in a very regular way to see are we closing the gap as we hope to. But the major way of getting support is through government support, and that's true, frankly, at the undergraduate, at the professional, and at the graduate levels. And so our starting point is always a sustained, effective, competitive investment of governments in support for our graduate students. And the federal government has been quite innovative in introducing new programs in the last decade. The Canada, the Millennium Scholarships, the Vanier Fellows, and the 2000 Canada Graduate Scholarships. But the gap is still there, and we know it. And so we'll stay at it. But I really urge you to make sure that you're making your needs known to your departmental chair and to your dean, and know that we're working hard at the table where all those folks come together to say, okay, what can we press now to make sure every time we're in front of government we're talking about this as a big need. So thank you.
Hi, my name is Ed Knox.
I'm an art student in U2, undergraduate. I just wrote this down so I wouldn't forget it. In light of SMU's insurance policy, so the Student Society of McGill University, and I suspect in their MOA, the McGill administration is absolved of all liabilities related to SMU and its activities, except independent student groups. Why is the administration inhibiting student groups from identifying with the McGill University by, for example, requiring student groups to specify McGill students as opposed to just McGill, in their names and their related activities?
Okay, again, there are several issues there. You started out with SMU and insurance policies.
Yes.
And I don't know anything about that.
I'm not sure. I think the key issue is the issue of the use of the McGill name by student groups.
That's the key issue. It's just sort of in light of the fact that I'm not sure how I see it as a liability concern. That was sort of...
Well, for example, and, you know, let me try and use real-time examples of the last year. Last couple of years, there was a gun club or rifle a McGill student, was it a gun club or a rifle?
McGill Rifle Club.
McGill Rifle Club that started up overnight just kind of out of the blue to use an example where you just can imagine the liabilities that are there. And if people say, as you will, don't make rules for the exceptions when the main event is healthy and part of the university community, the problem is we end up dealing with the exceptions all the time. So the idea is not to not have McGill's name on appropriate student clubs and societies. It's not to create a sense of distance between our students and the institution, au contraire. But it is to have some process that I think is quite an expedited process to make sure that clubs and societies are legitimate. And the relationship with SMU, as the relationship with PGSS and our part-time student society and the McDonald campus student society, really are there to reflect the different relationships that we have with those student groups to support their activities, but also to allow them to have some independence in the way they operate on your behalf.
Okay.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Tyler Lawson. I'm in arts, U1. Question. It concerns tuition increases. And my question basically focuses on alternatives. Have there been any alternatives explored? I mean, it is said that we have some of the smartest undergraduate students at this university in the country, very capable students. What has the university done to create work groups or anything in the past or currently, seeing as we're still pressed and have a lack of resources to explore these alternatives, yeah, to involving the stakeholders who are immediately affected by the projected tuition increases?
Right. We've had enormous consultation on the policies, public policies around tuition fees, but let me just say in a different way what I responded on graduate support, student support. Tuition fees are not where we start. Tuition fees are one small piece, and let me just say there, we do not propose tuition fees as they have south of the border. We're talking about the Canadian average of tuition fees at the undergraduate level, and our starting point is sustained effective levels of government support. The problem is that, just take the Quebec support, for example, when I came to McGill in 2003, there was a $350 million gap in average funding, so if you size adjust across the country, between Quebec and the rest of the country. But government support was the highest in the country. Today, government support has fallen to fifth or sixth in the country, and then we lack in Quebec the culture of philanthropy, the other mechanisms in place, and then, you know, very low tuition fees. So tuition fees, in our view, have their place if they're accompanied by a commitment to growing student aid. But our first stop is government, and we work very hard with philanthropists. We work with governments both in Ottawa and Quebec according to their appropriate missions. And we've worked with student groups in developing our position, which has been constant now for 3 or 4 years. We work very closely with the student leadership of the day in developing those positions. That doesn't mean there's an agreement on raising tuition fees, but it sure means that we've had strong student engagement on all the component parts of that. When I was a student, I wasn't arguing for tuition fee increases either, but it was and I borrowed money to get through school, but it was the best investment I ever made. And I think if the tuition fees are fair and there's enough student aid that those who have not the financial means to pay them have a means of support, with the current levels of funding and the current tuition fee framework we have in Quebec, I cannot say today that every qualified student can come to McGill independent of financial means. That's our goal. And through these other means, working on philanthropy on our campaign, which is dominantly directed towards student support, not all, but dominantly, working with governments, we've raised the support coming in, but we are still, the gap is actually growing with the rest of Canada, even on the level of government investment. And we simply have, you know, many of the issues that you raise as students to us and at the local level, space being a great example, get right down to a lack of resources. And so we need to find ways of balancing that out. And we feel it's fair public policy to ask those who can afford to pay more for something that benefits you more than anyone else at the end of the day. Of course, it benefits society broadly, but to pay what you can pay. Okay. Thank you.
Hi, Victor Chisholm. I'm a McGill graduate, BA 97, and I currently work in the Faculty of Science in the Office for Undergraduate Research. I'd like to suggest that McGill can learn a thing or two from the Quakers when it comes to information technology. The Quakers invented the vacuum cleaner so that they had more time to pray. I'm not suggesting that we pray, but bear with me, because they decided that they wanted to do a certain amount of work and they wanted to spend less time doing it. If I consider the IT initiatives that I interact with as an administrator, these are things like McGill Marketplace, the e-calendar, expense reports online. Typically what it means is that we get a better final product, or the same final product, but we do the same amount of work, or we do more work. So we've become mastered by technology. Technology is un multiple summit instead of we taking charge of it. What I would like to ask is a commitment that for future IT projects, and this could go for other initiatives too, that there be a commitment that they reduce work, not only centrally, but throughout all the units, instead of downloading work down, where work has not become easier. I think especially with Bill 100, we'll have to adjust to not do more with more, not even to do the same amount, but to do less with much less. So what kind of commitments will we have moving forward?
Excellent points about technology. I'm interested in your experience, and that's part of the reason we have the town halls, is to really, for me to learn, and those who are here from the senior administration to learn more about the experience at the local level. So thank you for that. The complaint I hear most often with respect to technology is that we implement systems that have a lot of robustness but are not necessarily user-friendly. And I don't know to what extent that interacts with your experience.
So we perfect example for the e-calendar, something that should have taken me 1 hour to do 10 paragraphs on paper, took me, say, 5-7 hours. I don't want to pick too much on e-calendar because I'm sure there's another side of the thing, but we introduce more and more complex systems where paper is actually much simpler and doesn't require training, doesn't require huge amounts of IT.
I don't think we're going to go back to paper in a major way.
Clearly.
But I think I agree with you totally that we need to have electronic supports that do support and not challenge.
Future projects be implemented not only to achieve central goals, but also with a full viewpoint of the full process down the line.
Yeah. And I think this gets back to the theme of consultation and having user groups when we make changes, and I support that totally. Thank you.
Hi, Joseph Giardini, U3 Neuroscience. In September, McGill hosted a bike forum to discuss the administration's policy regarding the ban of bicycle riding on campus. At the forum, a large number of students, professors, and other members of the McGill community expressed their displeasure with the decision and provided a large range of alternatives to the current policy. Most of those alternatives were greeted with a blanket statement that they had been considered but were deemed unsuitable, without actual specific problems being given, despite many people presenting a variety of research showing how some of these policies have been implemented well in other areas, and especially in urban centers. At the end of the forum, those who attended were promised that there would be follow-up. To my knowledge, no follow-up has taken place. What is currently being discussed to follow up on that forum and to follow up on the displeasure of the local community with that administrative decision?
Let me say that it was a broad set of administrative decisions that were taken, and they were broadly consulted. And the major decision was to make the lower campus vehicle-free and to close off McTavish to students. And vehicles includes bicycles as well as cars and trucks, except for delivery purposes. That particular session that was held was as much to share information as it was to move forward. I don't know, Professor Neisel, if there was a commitment to come back. That wasn't my understanding. My understanding was an information sharing. The bottom line is, let me say that I satisfied myself, and I know Professor Neisel did as well, that all of the recommendations that came in were considered. A number of amenities were created, particularly in the accommodation of bicycles around the perimeter of the campus. But the bottom line is that safety is the ultimate obligation of the university.
But there's still cars on campus after 11:30 that are not here for deliveries.
There are still cars that are, or there's still bicycles that are riding too, and we're working very hard to eliminate those at the margins who are not complying with the regulations that are there. But there are still far more bikes racing across campus in these early hours of darkness now. And people get hit. I almost got hit. I had two bikes collide. One guy landed on the back of my back. So it's not, you know, you'll have your own experiences, but we have a list of people who have been hurt by bicycles. Before the new regulations came in, cars also created a huge hazard for pedestrians, and we're working hard to have people comply with the new regulations. So I
my
hope that you'll also appreciate
the new regulations, though. It's about follow-up to the consultation that was implemented, and follow-up was promised.
Well, I don't know, Professor Neisel, if you, that wasn't my understanding.
At the session, what we promised to do was to follow up with the full minutes of the meetings and all the comments and post them on the web so that everybody would have an understanding of the information that was gathered and shared over the course of that meeting. We've done that. There are still groups that are working on a every couple of weeks or meeting to look at, again, the broader issue of this whole project just to see how it is going to manifest itself over the coming years.
But let me just be clear. There's not an appetite for going back on cars or bicycles on campus.
Do you feel you're expressing the views of the McGill community or just the administration?
Far and away, the majority of the university has expressed total support for this effort. And as always happens, when people are unhappy, they're more vocal, right? But there's been massive support for it. And safety is, at the end of the day, the most important thing. And I would submit that you can walk your bicycle in 5 minutes across the lower campus, and I would imagine you can do that. And what we do want to do is make sure that there are spaces around the campus for bicycles so people can come in and out and that the Bixies are close by so that you can use them. I can see you're unhappy. I'm sorry about that.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, Jeremy Bunyaner, Arts U1. McGill Food and Dining Services says their goal is to offer pleasant and memorable dining experiences through distinct food sensations. Bear with me. That capturing the culinary creativity and essence of Montreal. But the MOAs of the student organizations, student associations, actually block the potential for student food on campus. And I was wondering, doesn't it seem that these MOAs contradict the goal of creating distinct food services on campus, and why do the MOAs block student groups from providing food?
Well, in fact, PGSS and SMU both have their own food services on campus.
Well, I was more like EUS or
AUS. But I'm just saying it is a fact that we have major food services operated by the two largest student organizations on campus. And I don't know, Professor Mendelson, if you want to add further to that.
Excuse me.
I do see and I do live the fact that food is really, really important, and it comes up as a theme on a regular basis, no matter what the configuration is. So,
the short answer, not to detract from the principal's time, is that student groups were given the right or the privilege of providing food services in the 90s. Under their MOAs, the system created a number of problems, and in the late 90s, the university repatriated the right to provide coordinated food services, which has enabled development of some of the physical spaces, has enabled the use of the meal plan across campus and other benefits. The location for student-run operations are in, as the principal said, are in Thompson House for PGSS and in the University Center for SMU. Interestingly, SMU does not only offer student-run food operations, but has corporate food operations as well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Michael Ethan. I'm a PhD candidate in the Faculty of Music. I speak to you as a future professor. I've started to interview to become an associate professor in musicology. And in my experience and from the literature that I've read, I think the surest sign of a healthy university is the percentage of faculty who are on the tenure track, which is an obvious concern for someone like me. Principal Bloom, what is your stance on tenure, and what is McGill doing to maintain or, better yet, increase the percentage of teachers here who are on the tenure track?
We have a deep and abiding commitment to tenure, so don't for one moment think that. I mean, that is the my view, and tens of millions of other people. The whole notion of tenure as associated with academic freedom is sort of the core value of the university. So, just on the proportionality, I don't know which direction you were suggesting as a sign of health, whether there are more pre-tenure.
I think the more who are on tenure track, the better. I think sectionals often demonstrate less investment in the university as a whole.
I see. Look, I think we have a good balance at McGill. We have grown our tenure stream professoriate by about 20% over the last decade from what it was at the start of the ramp up. This is the way that I've come to understand it. If you were at McGill 15 years ago, less than 10% of the faculty would have come in the prior decade. Today, well over half of the faculty has come in the last decade. In fact, 60%, I think, looking at my colleague here, because the numbers literally continue to change. So we continue, even in a time of economic constraint, to hire. Our major thrust of hiring tenure stream professors is over. We did this incredibly aggressive, over 950 tenure stream people hired in under a decade. So just a huge, as I say, over half of our tenure stream people. And a majority of those have come again in the last decade. So it's not that we've been shy about hiring tenure stream professors at all. And even with the constraints, as the academic plan goes through its next iteration, we continue to plan to hire, but it'll just be more at the margins because we have this brand new professoriate. And our goals now are to really help our new professors land well, engage in both teaching and research at the undergraduate and graduate level, and okay. Make that successful.
Thanks.
Okay.
Hello, my name is Sarah Skoronsky from the Department of English. I'm a graduate student, a doctoral candidate, and I would actually like to build upon some of Emily's earlier comments just in terms of resources for graduate students available. And I'm not thinking here in terms of grant money, but one of the concerns in our department, within the graduate student body and, of course, the undergraduate student body, although I only speak tonight for the graduate students, is the recent decline in courses taught during the summer by graduate students. And I'm just going to give you a small example. 2 years ago, 2009, there were 6 undergraduate student English courses available for students, and traditionally many students have relied upon these courses in order to be able to graduate in a timely fashion, et cetera, et cetera. Unfortunately, last spring, this number dropped to only 2 courses. And speaking myself as a graduate student, I know that I certainly rely heavily upon the research and teaching positions that I'm able to get within my own department. Also, it's very important in terms of building my CV and ensuring that once I'm out on the market, as other graduate students already are, that I'll be employable. The third concern, of course, is for undergraduate students, ensuring they can graduate in a timely fashion, and this is purely anecdotal, but I've encountered several undergraduate students who are still here this term because they were unable to take courses they expected to be able to take last spring. And so we've consulted with our department chair, our graduate chair, and also our undergraduate chair, in addition to the graduate student body and the undergraduate student body, and I'm wondering if you can tell me if it might be a possibility to increase some of the course availability, both for the benefit of our undergraduate and graduate student population, in the future?
Well, I can't speak at the level of the department at all, but let me say again that the issue of the total financial package available to our graduate students is a high point of preoccupation and priority for us, and we're working very hard on it. There will be some balancing as we have this brand new professoriate of courses taught by professors and courses taught by graduate students. And, you know, our goal is that our students get a great exposure to our professors, as well as having the support of graduate students that I talked about when you have a bigger proportion of graduate students to the undergraduate students.
Absolutely, and I understand that. But my concern was purely with the spring-summer courses, which I hesitate to say never, but in my experience, never taught by tenured or tenure-stream faculty. Mm-hmm. They go to either graduate students or lecturers from outside of the university.
So let me just hear that, because it's the first time I'm hearing about it. But I also hear the message underneath it, which is the lack of resources to let you get through in a timely fashion. And we're working hard at that. There's a bit of a paradox as well, which is that the grants that come in for graduate students only come for a number of years, and so us working with you to get you through in a timely fashion is a collective goal, because when we don't, it also has an impact on the undergraduate student body.
Well, and I would like to emphasize that, of course, the financial impact is great, but also it's a pedagogical impact that I'm thinking of here.
But my understanding was, and we have Dean Crisworth here, that we're working hard on getting the teaching skills development out to our graduate students across the board. And so that you don't need to necessarily tie the two to a spring or summer course. But I hear you, and I thank you for your contribution.
Thank you.
Hi, Adrian Katz, PhD student in engineering. My question is about mandate, and it's about McGill's position on tuition. And the question is as follows. When you went to the Parliamentary Commission on Culture and Education in Quebec and said that McGill's position effectively is to relieve the Quebec tuition freeze and to allow tuition to rise in this province. On whose behalf were you speaking? Who authored that position? Who gave you the mandate to do that?
The Board of Governors.
So this is the Board of Governors.
Mm-hmm.
Was the Postgraduate Student Society consulted?
I've spoken with the Postgraduate Student Society, indeed last year, prior to the commission on this very
And did they sign on to the notion that the Quebec tuition fees
should
be lifted?
As I said, students have never signed on to increase tuition fees.
So we can take it that neither did the Student Society of McGill University?
You asked, was there consultation and discussion? Yes. You didn't ask.
I'm asking now, did any...
In fact, there have been student groups that have signed on. But at the level of the university student societies, we've not asked any to sign on.
So within the McGill community, this is specifically about your representation of the McGill community.
I do it as principal of McGill.
As principal of McGill, but MUNACA, TAGSEM, AMUSE, the Senate, the student societies, nobody supports this position.
That's not true.
Well, who does?
That's not true. And remember, there are representatives of every one of the constituencies on the Board of Governors.
So if you have, our board has how many seats on it?
25.
How many of them are student seats?
Do you really want to get into a discussion of governance?
Yes.
You're not asking a question, you're making a point. Why don't you just make your point then?
My point is, I don't believe that when you say that tuition should rise, then you say this to the Quebec government on behalf of the McGill community, that you're representing the McGill community. I think you're representing
welcome.
The Board of Governors, and I think the Board of Governors represents, in large part, people that are external to the McGill community.
That's simply not true. Simply not true.
How many of the people on the board?
Administrative and support staff, professoriate, students.
So was this voted on at the board,
no.
The position?
No,
so the board didn't even support
it.
So there was an approval, there was a vote that you would go to the Standing Committee on Culture and Education and tell our government that McGill thinks tuition should rise.
It was presented as for information to the board, and I heard no dissent to it. So.
Thank you.
Thank you. And there, let me say, this is not a one-time discussion. This has been an ongoing discussion for years. And let me say as well that my position is never as a priority to raise tuition fees, that is to have sustained effective levels of government support, to have effective levels of philanthropy, and to not raise tuition fees without an investment that is far above what we do right now in student aid. So just have my position clear. Thank you. Please.
I'm Miriam Zaidi, Arts U4. My question, and you just, well, I'm going to come back to what you just said. This, I just turned it off.
No, we can hear you.
Oh, did I? Okay. So you said that basically your position is not to increase tuition, and you said...
No, I said as a priority. It's
as a priority, true. Yes. And that, you know, if government gave you more funding and all the funding that you needed to solve the underfunding crisis, you wouldn't want to turn to that. And my question is...
Quebec's gone from number one in the country to number five or six in the country in terms of its level of support for universities. But let me say, because I believe in it... No, but you're just making assertions about what I believe, so I'm happy to leave it. But I believe that students should pay a fair share of their education to the extent of their means.
Okay. I don't agree.
You're just saying that was my position. I'm saying that wasn't my position.
My question is, do you think that, how much do you estimate the underfunding in Quebec for universities?
There's actually been a study done. It's $800 million compared to the average of the rest of Canada for the system.
And do you think there is nowhere in Quebec, you can't get $800 million in Quebec? There's nowhere in the government, and the businesses,
there's no jurisdiction in North America that funds quality and accessibility on government support alone.
Okay.
And Quebec has amongst the lowest GDP in North America. So in answer to your question, I think it'd be dreaming in technicolor to say that they're going to come up with $1 billion that's going to fill the gap. If we could wave a magic wand, that would be a great thing.
But that's what the Kripuk is pushing, and they say it's $800 million that would fill the gap. Okay. So you're saying that's not what would fill the gap?
Pardon me?
You're saying that wouldn't fill the gap.
I'm saying there's no way of getting that money out of government.
Okay.
That's what I'm saying.
Thank you.
The resources simply aren't there. So the economy of Quebec is not... when I say the GDP is amongst the lowest in North America, that's simply another way of saying that we're not a rich province.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May I just point out that's $800 million per year.
Per year, yeah. And then just to give you some examples, we have as a university $650 million in deferred maintenance. We have a landlocked lower campus. Our biggest campus is landlocked here. With that deferred maintenance problem. And we have costs in infrastructure development out at McDonald campus that we cannot even begin to think about. That's why there are buildings that are just boarded up out there. And so when we talk about our own underfunding, that doesn't include the $650 million in deferred maintenance, which affects all of you as you want space to study and do other things. Okay.
Hi, Erin Hale, U3 Arts. So you're meeting on December 6th with the government and many other principals and representatives of student federations. I have two questions. We were taking a look at the agenda, and the question seems to be not will these tuition increases be decided, it's how. I don't know if that seems a little linguistically troubling, but so maybe you can answer that. And my second question is, it seems that there are more seats at this meeting for the private sector than for students.
First of all, this is not my meeting. Whatever's happening
on December 6th.
I'm just saying that what's happening in Quebec City has been determined by the ministry, not by me. So I'm not.
I don't know what your thoughts are on it.
But your first question was. Just go back to it.
It was just like linguistically, the agenda is a little concerning.
Okay. The finance minister of Quebec committed in the budget of last spring that tuition fees will rise in 2012. So I think and there are three themes, as I understand it, I've just learned about it as you have, kind of how it's developed. And I think that day is one day in a series of days. Is that right, Vaughan? My colleague Vaughan Dowie. On different themes related to post-secondary stage apps and different happening on different days?
There's around. One on universities, there's a series on stage apps around the province. There was the issue of that they dealt with about children with learning difficulties in primary school.
Okay.
And then there'll be a final meeting on democratization of the schools.
The school meaning lower primary, secondary, we don't know. We don't know what it means. So the commitments there, that was a decision undertaken by the finance minister. What we don't know is what will accompany it, how it will be expressed, how much it'll be, over what period of time, and the CRAPUC position is a simple one, that more investments needed to support accessibility, and that tuition fees need a significant increase. But that's the level of detail at that table. So it's, again, putting in tandem increased student aid with increased...
Will Quebec students be applicable for the student aid, or will that just go to out-of-province students?
Quebec students get first call on much of the student aid that's there, except at McGill, where we try and provide student aid across all of the student groups.
And the second part was about the private sector having more seats. Do you think that's a problem, or
I actually don't know about that. I don't know exactly what the configuration is. We were trying to figure out who was going to be at the table, because there are 120 people invited to the day, and then there's a table, and I'm not sure who's around the table at the end of the day. So I think that in terms of I just simply don't know. I shouldn't guess what it is. What I would hope for the McGill community, and I would hope this would be true across the province, is that where we can agree on points to communicate in the context of that public debate, that we do that. So the need to have a sustained, effective level of government investment that has Quebec amongst the highest in Canada as a government investor in post-secondary education, that there be a commitment to improving the investment in student aid. I would also put in a plug on the investment in graduate studies as well, so that we're, by competitive, I mean not punching, but that we offer resources that are equal to what you would get if you were a student in another province. And that any rise in tuition be accompanied by an increase in student aid that goes to the university where the students are paying their fees. One of the things you may not know, and this is one of the real challenges for us, is that for our students who come from out of province, if you come from the rest of Canada, you pay the average of Canadian fees, which is just under $6,000. If you come from out of the country, you pay another fee, which is closer to $16,000 or $17,000 at the undergraduate level. We get to keep the Quebec tuition fee portion of that. And then, like all the other universities, get a grant, so that our McGill students, by far the biggest population of students from outside of Quebec, subsidizes the rest of the system to the tune of tens of millions of dollars a year. So we would start with just let the students who come here keep their tuition fees at the university that you're studying at. We think that's a point of fairness. Okay.
Excuse me, we have less than 10 minutes, and we have 7 people standing there, so we certainly can't have anyone else join the line. And I'd urge you to keep your questions very, very crisp.
And my answers,
and your
crisp,
answers
yeah.
are crisp.
Hi, Carter Lee, PhD candidate in medicine. My question is concerning the liability issue with the use of the McGill name. From my understanding of the negotiations, it's between directly from the McGill administration and SMU. What is the consideration of the services or the clubs themselves in terms of communicating with them, because the SSMU will be negotiating on their behalf? So would the McGill administration consider communicating with them on this issue?
Okay, we want to put a response on the website. Why don't I suggest that that's one issue we'll follow up on the website,
okay,
to get back on. Thank you.
Hi, first of all, I wanted to thank you for this forum. I'm sure all of us appreciate it, so I'll keep it short. First of all, I just want to correct Professor Mendelson about student services and food. We, in fact, do have two student-run food services in the Shatner Building, or the University Center, as the administration calls it. One of them is Organic Campus, that provides organic food, and second is Midnight Kitchen. So we do, in fact, have student-run food services. Secondly, SMOOS services are an integral part of the university, and they often fill a gap that McGill Student Services do not provide, for example, a sexual assault center, or Queer McGill, which is a safe space for queer students. Why is it that, again, the issue of the McGill name, why is it that they, such integral services for the community, are not even allowed to use the McGill name, even though a lot of their services are directly helping students, which make up the largest part of campus community. In fact, just outside there's a sign of McGill First Aid Service, MFAS, which provides first aid service for students and residents and on campus.
Well, I tried to answer your question in a generic way, and I don't know that I'm going to add much more detail to that. Every one of these that sounds simple on the face of it is more complex in the implementation. And we work hard, and I know my colleague Professor Mendelson does particularly. He ends up being the meat in the sandwich on some days because he's working both to bring the voice and the request of students to the administration and also dealing with the liability issue, the financial resource issues, the fact that for every request we get here, we get 1,000 over there, and we're constantly trying to, you know, underfunding means something in terms of what we can and can't do, and so we're always trying to be judicious in the way we approach that, and we don't say we always get it right, but we work to do that.
But the SMU never requests financial support, so it's not a matter of underfunding. It's more a matter of recognizing with the university.
Well, but it's also would act as though SMU was the only entity in the university. I was talking about legal liability issues and.
But our insurance covers legal liability.
Well,
SMOOS insurance covers that.
Yes, but when you use the McGill First Aid name, that isn't a SMOOS name. That's the McGill University First Aid.
But it's a department of SMOOS. So
I understand
legally
that, but that's not the university writ large, right? And First Aid is something with the McGill name that the entire university community would view to be an institutional.
But I'm just wondering, what is your...
We're now going beyond the time with seven people standing behind.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, I'm Guy Lifschitz. Core science, computer science. Okay, so you've said repeatedly a few times, and in the past you've said that Quebec tuition should go towards Canadian tuition levels. Now, I know people who have acquired debt because they studied outside of the province, and they have to pay five or whatever $1,000 per year or per semester, and I'm not sure. The thing is, the middle class is getting less rich. The rich class is getting richer, and these differences are occurring, are getting bigger. The upper class, obviously, it's a small percentage that they can pay for tuition. I'm worried that financial aid will only help the lowest percentage of earners. I'm worried the middle class will be hurt by this and acquire a substantial amount of debt. And I'm wondering, why is it that you talk about, and the government talks about, reaching the Canadian standard, when, in fact, the Canadian standard should reach the Quebec standard?
Because there aren't the resources to do exactly that. If you could achieve that, both accessibility and quality, we'd have a different debate. But let me say your point about the middle class is a really important one. And Bob Ray was commissioned to do a report in Ontario to look at exactly how to get this balance right of government investment, of tuition levels, but also of the commitment to student aid. And he identified, as we have, that middle-class families, particularly those that have more than one child or one family member going to university at the same time, have a special need. And I, by the way, I haven't heard the Quebec government talk about the average of Canada. So,
the leaked documents have stated that that's their goal.
I have never heard them say that. So, but anyways, the facts count. And so in that regard, I think what you talk about with respect to eligibility is really important and nuanced, and there are certainly many middle class families that would qualify for student support.
Right. Also,
there's no substitute for the gap in revenues that are there. currently.
Also, considering the line, though, I was going to request that you stay till 7:30, as the email you sent out said you would be staying till.
If it said I'm staying till 7:30, I'm staying till 7:30.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks. Did it? Okay. If it did, I'm happy to.
Hi, I'm Carol Fraser. I'm an arts undergraduate. Yeah. My question is about student space on campus.
Yeah.
Sister Pissimic or SMU building is constantly filled up with room bookings, and it seems like we have a really large student population that wants to get involved. And McGill puts a priority, or so it says, on student activities. I was wondering when the other buildings on campus would be opened up rent-free for student use, mm-hmm. and I was wondering why student groups have to pay rent in general to use campus space. I don't think professors pay for their office space, pay rent for it, or you don't pay rent to go to a classroom. So what's the difference there? And also, do libraries and lecture halls pay rent?
Okay. Spaces are scarcest commodity at McGill. And there are costs associated with bringing in groups on a part-time basis or a one-time basis. So we work hard to do everything we can to fairly recover the resources that we need. You know, when I say we're underfunded, it expresses itself in all of these ways, but we're not just underfunded, we are underspaced with respect to the mission of the university. So there have been a number of efforts made. There will be a priority for academic space. And as you heard, our graduate students don't have, we don't have a current circumstance where every graduate student has a place to study and to do their research and scholarship. So we have classrooms that are overloaded. We also have professorial office spaces and working areas that are constrained. So the first call will always be space. But we are doing our utmost to try and get more space and to make the judgments that will allow the academic mission to flow best supported, and also to give students some opportunities like this one.
I just have a specific example. We're concerning the space that was formerly the Architecture Cafe. Now it is an academic space. When it was the Architecture Cafe, it was cited in the report that went out that it was a problem that it was not paying rent. Now it's an academic space.
Well, I believe both points were made, and in the consultation within architecture and engineering, the need for student study space was identified as the highest priority.
It was a study space before. Thank you.
Yeah, well, I think that proves the point.
Hi, my name is Jan Floriancic. I'm a second-year master's in computer science. I'm the executive coordinator of TEDx McGill, and our event is happening 2 weekends from now, and we're gathering 600 people from across McGill and Montreal.
You might want to say a bit about what that is.
Sure.
But not at length.
No. And I've practiced giving this pitch so many times. That, we've inherited the internationally renowned brand of TED Talks, which has been nothing but a blessing, and will feature 18 short-form talks from students, staff, and special guests from Montreal alike on November 20th. Mm-hmm. Everywhere we've turned, at McGill, in Montreal, and even internationally in the TED and TEDx community, we've been met with goodwill, we've been vetted positively, and generally our event is only possible because of all this great support we've had. But for the entire preparation process, which has been about 9 months now, I've struggled figuring out what exactly we are. And I really wish that other student or initiatives like this can occur. So my question is basically, what space does an initiative like this occupy? And
you mean how does one get priority for special initiatives?
Because we're entirely student run. We're not affiliated with SMU. We're not under a specific department. And yet, we've been encouraged to keep going. Mm-hmm. And so I was wondering what your thoughts were on having more things like this happen.
The support has been ad hoc?
Yes.
Yeah. A lot of things happen on an ad hoc support basis, right? And a lot of good things happen that way. So, I mean, you mentioned yourself that you have SMU to talk to about this, but it sounds like you have been able to get the support that you need. Let me say that for every initiative like this that may be proposed, there are also new research institutes, new scholarly centers, so it goes on and on, very much overlapping from kind of student life and also professorial and staff life to the core program, academic and research and scholarly programs at the university. So that's where we're constant weighing. And I guess for me, you know, it would be great if we were an elite Ivy university with more resources than we knew what to do with. But I actually like McGill better. I actually think what we do is better. I think that the entrepreneurial and innovative and resourceful nature of our students and our staff is fantastic. And so we do a lot. We're a big place. We're messy sometimes. But I've got to say that the end result is really a pretty fantastic one. So I applaud you for doing what you're doing. And I just say stay at it.
Okay.
You know, stay at it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hi, Kaylee Lins, U2 Arts. I'm just wondering about the $150 non-refundable application fee that's been applied to all students applying for international exchanges. I'm just wondering about exactly how $150 was arrived at for the exact amount. Also, whether it's been considered if a cancellation fee would better achieve the goal of deterring students from canceling. Also, why was there no student consultation in the process? And basically, has it been considered that this might deter students from applying for international exchange opportunities?
What was the last point? Sorry,
if the administration has considered whether it would deter students from applying for these international exchange opportunities.
We don't have a lack of students applying for international exchange. I don't know if you wanted to respond or to put that.
I can respond very quickly, but I think this is something that I'd like to post so that, because I don't want to use up the principal's time. The main purpose of the fee, there were two main purposes of the fee. One of the purposes was to, as you say, discourage students from canceling at the last minute, because last year and for the past number of years, many students cancel at the last minute, which means that places that could be used by students who are really interested can't be filled. So this is to ensure that students can, in fact, use the fees. The cancellation fee doesn't do that because we want people to apply who are clearly interested in the experience, not the cancellation fee wouldn't accomplish the same thing. So that's the main issue of the fee. The other issue of the fee is that there have been many improvements in the services that we offer to students going on an exchange, and those services take money. So it's always the issue that the principals come back to this over and over again. There's money spent to provide services to a group of students, and we want to provide the services. Students have told us that those services are worthwhile and valuable and important, and we need the money to supply the services.
So the cancellation fee is going to funding then for those?
It's all one.
It's serving multiple.
Right.
It's serving multiple.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Robin Reed Fraser, U1 Arts. I was just wondering, once you told us that it was an $800 million kind of gap that you're facing, I was just curious as to what you were expecting that the raise in tuition would, how much that would be able to kind of fill in that gap.
The dominant share has to come from sustained effective levels of government support, not from tuition. At McGill, we are roughly 15% less of our total revenues come in from tuition than would be the case at the other universities with our mission in the rest of Canada. If we could even achieve half of that, that's more resources for all the things you're talking about. Okay. But that cannot come at the expense of either growing student aid or having government play the role that it should. And we would say as well, our alumni and others in society who benefit from the fact that you'll go out and do good things once you're through your education here. Thank you.
Thanks. Hi, Ian. Tyler Lawson, U1 Arts.
I think you need to. Well, yeah. Go ahead.
No, just for clarity's sake. My question kind of concerns the general atmosphere. There's an extensive sentiment on campus that students don't necessarily have a say, and to the extent that they would appreciate in the administrative goings-on or governance matters on campus. And I'm particularly interested in this new working group to examine existing and perhaps deficient means of, or insufficient means of student consultation. There's currently a research project ongoing to see what other models exist on other campuses across this country, in the United States, in Europe, and abroad. I was just wondering what your thoughts were personally on the potential opportunity for students to, you know, for campus to be more democratic, for there to be more students on the Board of Governors, for students to have the ability to make binding decisions on matters of finance, for students to have the opportunity to make binding decisions on advisory groups of Senate, to effectively shape their community in the ways that they see fit, because there's a lot of frustration right now.
Yeah, let me respond to two elements of what you're saying. One is we have a group of, I don't know, I'm not good at estimating numbers, however many people that are in this room, and most of you have expressed a complaint or an unhappiness or a desire to have something different than it is. We have, as I said, a huge community. We have 35,000 students. We have another 12 to 15,000 people who are employees of the university. We have 200,000 graduates around the world. I hear overwhelmingly, just on our campuses, positive feedback about the university, about the experience for our students, about the experience of our professors and our admin and support staff. So I actually have a whole lot of different mechanisms to reach out, to consult, just I'm talking personally. And every one of my colleagues, you know, departmental chairs, deans, the VPs, frankly, the senators, the governors on the Board of Governors all do. So I actually don't go home at night saying, gee, there's a terrible mood on campus, and you can try and create that through the student media. But it flies in the face, frankly, of wanting to have a constructive dialogue about what we can work on together. And it is not the only voice by far on campus. So point number one. Point number two on the Board of Governors, we have been fighting for 3 years a movement by the Quebec government, which, by the way, is being mirrored in many of the provinces across the country and in states south of the border, to have, you know, no internal representatives on boards of governors, to have only people from the outside. We have fought that tooth and nail. We have fought to have every one of our constituencies represented on our board, and we intend to keep it that way. But we've worked hard to actually do an examination of the various governance practices in universities with our mission across the continent, and took a two-year exercise to consult and go from a different board system to the one that we've got today. And we're quite proud of it. And nothing's perfect, as I said. We're all works in progress, and our organizations are as well.
So I guess my question is, would you entertain the idea of campus democracy, the idea of perhaps...
I think there's tremendous campus democracy.
I mean, well, it's in administrative matters. Perhaps there's been talks of, ideally, the opportunity to perhaps elect the position of the deputy provost as a voice for students within the administrative process, or if that's too far-fetched. I mean, I do want to go back a little bit and talk about what you're saying, because here there is a significant amount of...
You should know that students sit on the advisories to appoint academic administrators and other administrators.
I understand.
Many
that.
Universities don't have that.
Okay, but there are also universities with a significantly higher percentage
Tell
of students.
Tell me where students appoint VPs or deans.
Pardon me?
Tell me where students appoint VPs.
Not particularly that, but say the Board of Governors.
Okay.
And what I wanted to address...
Where do students appoint the Board of Governors?
I've heard that at Trent University, where certain administrators here
You've
have worked
that.
Previously.
Yes. I think facts count.
Well, okay, when we get that research project finished...
Trent has a different mission than McGill does.
Madam Principal, can I just follow up?
Yes.
One thing that...
But I actually expect our students to work from the facts.
Oh, okay. We'll have those soon. But, I mean, facts aside, ideals. Let's talk ideals. Let's talk ideals. Because, I mean, raising tuition to the national average doesn't necessarily make it right. Conforming a system to the national average, say in residences, doesn't necessarily make it right.
What? I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Well, I'm just talking about examples where conformity has been expressed as the proper means about going and creating an institution that's supposed to be student-centered. And speaking to your point about representatives or constituents or students, I'm curious as to see what kind of existing means there are that you work with, because I can tell you right now, the entire exec of the Student Society of McGill University is here. The Senate is here, all the student senators constituents.
I don't believe that's the case, that all the student senators are here.
Well, there is a large portion of them here. Let's see, myself, Joshua Abaki, Amara Possum. Well, it is, though, because I do believe that these concerns are indicative of the greater sentiment on campus. We are representatives. We have constituents. And to say that we don't adequately represent those constituents, I'm interested to see where you're getting that information.
From the students I meet at the classroom level, at the various events happening across campus, I actually believe in the organizations we have, but they are... We have an unusual representative system in terms of students, which is that the same students sit on board, the same students sit on Senate, and the same students are the executive of the student associations. Many universities have a much more distributed student leadership across the university in the various governing bodies and in the relationships with the senior administration. So, you know, if you're looking at best practices, you might look at some of those models. We welcome the opportunities to consult. I think you've made your point, and we have a process underway to look at consultation. But the administration's responsible for the management of the university. That's the job we have. I serve at the pleasure of the board, and the Senate has broad student representation on it. We have more student representation in the appointment of people than most universities, and certainly than most universities with our mission. So again, I'm not saying we're perfect, but I think having more voices and hearing the full range of voices and having the various vehicles that represent students give full voice is really important.
Cool. And I thank you for this consultative body, that this town hall, but as well as that committee on consultation to review existing means.
Thank you.
We're just going to have time for a couple more questions.
Miriam again. I have a fact actually to back up what Tyler said. In University of Laval, they have an electoral college where there are certainly more than two student representatives sitting on it, and that college elects the principal of the university. So there are more democratic forms for students.
Yes, it is the only one. It's the only one in North America.
We can follow the best example, if it's only one.
I hope you also appreciate your experience at McGill.
I beg your pardon?
I hope you also appreciate your experience as a McGill student.
So my question is about the 30 cents per dollar. Basically, your plans for tuition increases, you're pushing for kind of tuition increases.
We've done for 6 years, because there has been an unfreezing, as you know.
Yeah.
That 30 cents
of
every net new dollar.
Okay.
Goes into student aid at McGill.
Yeah. And you're saying, you wrote in an email that you agree that tuition should continue to increase, and maybe even higher, I don't know. Higher, because you're aiming for the Canadian average. And then you're saying that 30 cents of each dollar will go to financial aid here at McGill. Which
net new dollar.
Net new dollar.
Okay, so if the money doesn't come to McGill, as with our... Canadian students from outside of Quebec and our international students, that isn't net new money to McGill.
Okay.
Okay, so we can't build student aid if the money doesn't come to us.
Exactly. That is a commitment that you have made.
And that we're expressing.
Yeah, okay, thank you. I should stand next to you and we can talk together. You can finish my sentences. So the thing is, basically, even if you promise to give 80 cents per net new dollar to student aid, this is a commitment that you made to McGill students. Considering that the tuition increases that you have a stance for, that you are pushing for, will affect all of Quebec students, and that other principals in other universities don't have a similar stance, what would you say to all these other Quebec students that will basically have to make a choice between university or their dreams and just going to the workforce and having a job that they
interesting. Sorry, finish.
Yeah. What would you say to those students? Are you aware that this will affect all of students all over Quebec, even in the regions?
Yeah, well, again, just, you know, someone who started life as a social worker, I care a lot about accessibility. And the fact is that Quebec has one of the lowest university participation rates in Canada. Mm-hmm. It has one of the lowest degree completion rates in Canada. So the fact of low tuition hasn't equaled accessibility, participation, or degree completion rate. The fact is that if you're poor, you need money to go to university. You need housing, you need food, you need all the things that come with that. So low tuition alone just simply doesn't. It's a great, accessibility is a value I hold dear. It's one that we've made a big commitment to, but it is not one that's met by low, frozen, or no tuition as costs increase across the board. So I'm not speaking for all of Quebec students. I'm speaking as the principal of McGill. Mm-hmm. In the face of a university with our mission, which is a complex mission and quite different than the missions of some of the universities in the rest of, but we are, we would share a mission with, for example, of having a faculty of medicine with three other universities in Quebec. And there, I think there is a strong understanding that we need to be able to keep the revenues that our students bring in at the university, and I hope whatever you feel about increased tuition fees, you will stand with us on saying sustained effective levels of investment from government, a big investment in student financial support, and keeping your fees at the university that you pay them at. And right now we're subsidizing, so my concern is not the rest of Quebec, where we're subsidizing students to go to other universities on the basis of tuition fees that students here bring in. It's getting the fees here and keeping them here.
We're going to go to the last.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks.
I was wondering, in the past year, there have been extreme cuts to both Tier 2 and Tier 3 sports teams and clubs at McGill University, to the extent that Tier 3 has lost varsity status, virtually all benefits, and actually now has to pay $100 to be considered a McGill club. Despite increases to Tier 1, which are roughly nine teams sharing $980,000, I was wondering if you could give any justification for this.
Yeah, I don't actually know this, so you're informing me about this in real time. What I'd like to do is undertake that this is one of the issues that we'll respond to.
Okay.
Unless, Professor Mendelson, you wanted to say something. I just simply don't know about the...
The Executive Director of Athletics and Recreation has explained to athletics in the community in a number of ways. I'll be happy to post the explanation on the website. The fact of the matter is that when you look at the number of students who benefited versus the number of students who were put at a disadvantage, there were in fact more students who benefited in the restructuring.
I think there are more teams that were actually diminished because of it. And again, the numbers speak greatly of the fact that nine teams at McGill share $980,000.
Yes.
Where there are another 10 or 11 teams that fall under Tier 3 that pay McGill to use the name. I just feel that that's kind of an embarrassment for the university, that they make student-athletes pay to be considered student-athletes at a given university.
Yeah. And the fact of the matter was that, and I think it still is the case, that McGill has more varsity teams than any other university in Quebec and has many more varsity teams than many universities across Canada. So the varsity system was broken. There was a full consultation and an implementation, but I'll be happy to post that.
Let me say at the same time, if I might, just to finish up on athletics, this is another area where the campaign is proving to be helpful, and I'm sorry you're disappointed, and I'm hearing you, but I'm not informed on the issue that you're describing. But we have had a number of alumni come forward and be very generous in supporting student athletics and varsity activities. And that's an area where, at the local level, participating in the campaign around a special team can be quite successful, and I know the development and alumni people would be very happy to work with you in that.
Second question, I guess, then. I was wondering, second and last, I'm afraid. Yeah. Okay. I was wondering if maybe then you could diminish the taxation or the transfer fee that goes through when alumni do donate to said sports teams at McGill. There is a fee that McGill Athletics takes out, so you can actually go in the bank account. I was wondering if maybe you could work on diminishing that.
Okay. Let me take that under consideration.
Okay, thank you.
But I understand the problem. Look, let me thank all of you for coming out. And one of the great things about a university is that we can exchange our views, have our understanding of the facts, and agree sometimes and disagree at other times. Someone's desperate. I'd say there will be another one. I said next time, you come out next time. But I want to really thank you for preparing as you have. I'm enormously proud to be principal of McGill, to be a professor at McGill, and to have you as our students. You are a remarkable group of students, and we are committed to working together to make the place as good as it can possibly be. So thank you for the time this evening. Thank you for coming out. Thank you for expressing your views.